Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. And before we get some calm analysis and get behind the noise with our panel this morning, let's have a look at the front pages of the papers. So the Irish Mail on Sunday is leading with Ukraine aid doubled to 100 million after Trump row. So there was 50 million approved last month, but they're saying here that the government has now doubled that aid package to 100 million in the wake of US President Donald Trump's humiliation of Vladimir Zelensky in the Oval Office. But never mind 100 million. The Business Post will take that 100 million and raise it to 750 million. They are saying that Ireland could be contributing up to that to a new EU security guarantee for Ukraine as Europe doubles down. And there is a senior government figure saying in that piece, this is what European solidarity looks like. It costs money, a lot of money. And that has not traditionally been how Ireland viewed European solidarity, we would have to admit. We haven't always seen it as something that we should be giving loads of money into. It worked very well for us for many, many years. But here we go. The Sunday Times. Never mind your 750 million. Welfare bill in United Ireland could hit 22 billion, they're saying. So they have a lot of pieces inside on potentially United Ireland. It should be said, there's a lot of disagreement about how you interpret the various figures and how much it would cost, how much you get back in social insurance, etc. So there are various models on that, you might say. Sunday Independent have a poll, and they're taking their lead out of that. Public split on whether Martin should criticise Trump. So we'll get into the details of that. But basically, that poll suggesting that more than 50% want Micheál Martin to focus on the issue of trade rather than bring up Ukraine and Gaza. 43% believe that the Taoiseach should offer direct criticism to Mr. Trump. The Mirror is leading with that terribly sad tragedy in Gortahurk in Donegal of two young men killed in that car accident. The Sun has the World War Tea. So you might have seen this. Trump went golfing yesterday. That's what he did after astounding dressing down of UK president in Oval Office. Unrepentant Trump hits the golf course this morning. And I did read somewhere else as well that J.D. Vance was off on holiday to Vermont and apparently had his holiday disturbed. Fox News were reporting by people protesting. So that's what the two of them went off and did after that, after those scenes. And then the Observer and the Sunday Telegraph are worth a look for the morning that's in it. Royal welcome for Zelensky after White House meltdown is the Observer's lead. And the Sunday Telegraph, you are very welcome to number 10. So Keir Starmer, who knew, maybe come at the man, come at the hour, but he must be in his picky, suddenly back at the heart of Europe. And he is for now anyway, I'd say, feeling like the main man here. So our panel this morning, Peter Brown is director at Bagot Investments. Harry McGee is political correspondent with the Irish Times. Tanya Ward is chief executive of the Children's Rights Alliance. And Professor Bridget Laffin is emeritus professor at the European University Institute. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Bridget Laffin, can I start with you? I suppose the piece you picked on this is Mark Galliotti. Can Ukraine survive without US aid? Zelensky may be about to find out. I'd be interested in your general picture of where you think things stand now after the last few days.
Well, Mark Galliotti ends that piece by arguing that if Trump moves directly from Zelensky to Putin, then the existing world order is overturned. So, in other words, all of the assumptions we have about the order in the world, the international institutions, NATO, UN, all of that, it is over. So I think we're at a switching time where we could have a very different kind of world to deal with. And that world would be a world in which international law matters for very little, international institutions matters for very little, and we're back in a world of great powers and spheres of influence, and a world in which large states will bully small states. So that's the that is the danger we face, and it
okay,
is.
Okay, so in the immediate then, so can Ukraine survive without US aid? I gather like that the weapons are already tapered off to practically nothing. The last promises of the Biden administration are playing out now. There's been no new pledge made by the US, and obviously it's looking up in the air now whether there will be any more. So can Europe step up here?
So I think we're Keir Starmer is convening a meeting in London today to look at that. The European Council is meeting on next Thursday to pledge a new defence fund. So Europe can help Ukraine in lots of different weapons areas, but there are certain things the US has in terms of intelligence and helping them, targeting and things that Europe, and air support, air protection, that Europe simply doesn't have the capability.
Yeah, so the intelligence seems to be a big piece of this. But come here, can I ask you a really simple question? Like, does this not boil down to that if America's out of the picture and Europe is over there at the front line, is Europe willing to eyeball the Russians and be prepared to go to war with them? Given that we, for 3 years, we haven't been prepared to give Ukraine enough to in any way win this war. We kept them on a kind of, like it was like methadone or something, a maintenance dose to keep them going. Yeah. Is Russia really going to believe any threat of Europe or any security guarantee of Europe?
So we don't know is the answer.
What would you think, though?
I think that Putin would not be afraid of Europe. Why should he be? In other words, they haven't managed to make an effective deterrence. They negotiated with him from a weak base. But Europe is unlikely to want to go down the tube in style. It's unlikely to want to leave itself exposed to what Russia can do, particularly the Baltic states, the Nordic states. So I would expect a robust European response, but it will be...
But with no credible threat behind it, really.
But it will be full of starts and stops and be very difficult. But remember that already Macron is saying to the Germans, we will put some of our nuclear air force into Germany. So you would see a reconfiguration of the security, underpinning security dynamics in Europe. Over what period, I don't know. But should we bet the house on Europe? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But we shouldn't underestimate them. Countries do respond, because if you're in the Baltics or in the Nordics, if you're Finland, you will not want to be exposed to an aggressive Russia.
Yeah.
This started with Trump.
Peter Brown.
Yes, sorry. This started with Trump promising to solve this very quickly. And he got into negotiations with the Russians. Right. Now, I'm sure in those negotiations, the Russians turned around and said, we're not conceding anything. We don't need to concede anything. We might be losing tens of thousands of troops. We don't care about that. We didn't
care
about that.
Trump wasn't asking them to concede anything either, was he?
No, but they're not in a position where they're going
Trump
to concede
conceded
anything.
Before he...
But the important point here is the Russian mentality. They lost a huge amount of troops in World War II. They don't care about troops. Their economy's in an awful state. They don't care about the people. Putin doesn't have to fight an election. He can keep going for a long, 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 long time. Now, when the Americans realised that, this crisis and this war was always going to get solved with the Ukrainians conceding, right? Because they're the ones who need the funds to keep going, and the funds are an issue now, right? And America, right, has said, look, you know, Zelensky, you need to concede here, and that's the way the peace is going to happen. And they got very annoyed when he didn't, right? So Starmer has got to be very careful here of stepping into a place that commits billions upon billions upon billions of keeping something going that's going to end in the end with Ukraine conceding. Regardless of whether anyone thinks that's right or not, it's the only solution. The Russians are not going to concede. They're not going to deal. They don't need to deal. Right. And that's really
then
important.
There's another
then,
argument
just
on that, and you can give the last piece then. There is an argument that the Russians are actually don't hold all the cards. Are interest rates in Russia gone up to 21% or something? They're running a war economy, which you can add into your GDP We made a tank and it's blown up in Ukraine the next day, but it's part of your GDP and you can make it look as if the economy is going great, but the economy is not going great.
No,
the sanctions are biting and they are starting to hurt.
Yes, but they're hurting the Russian people. And if you look at Russian history, right, they've never mattered. Russian soldiers on the battlefield getting slaughtered does never matter to the Russians, right? It doesn't matter to Putin. He'll keep that going for a long period of time. The Russian people aren't going to get up and protest. It's not going to happen. So he can keep going. Now, if you look at what happened with Trump, and Trump, what comes out of Trump's mouth has to be discounted because it just comes out of his mouth, right? But what's behind Trump is a serious array of very, very talented people, right, who are not blundering their way around here. And if Starmer turns around here and gets Europe to put up billions upon billions upon billions, and he's talking about 20 billion as the first hit, America's sitting there going, we saved 20 billion there, lads, and these guys have ponied up for 20 billion, and they're going to be there as long as it keeps going, and as long as Ukraine is allowed not to concede, Europe's going to pay for it forever.
Okay, so Tanya, if we call that the so-called realism school of foreign policy, you're probably a person who comes more from a social justice kind of leftist background. Would you agree with any of that? More money into a war that's going to end the way it's going to end anyway?
I mean, the only thing I'd say about Russia at the moment, it is very true the economy is now in its seeds. It's run out of resources. It's using ordinary vehicles and donkeys even to get resources to the front line. And it's true that Putin doesn't really care. He has a meat grinder army. He always has done. And he has other reasons why he's willing to sacrifice the economy. Like, Ukraine is providing a window of democracy and he has to eliminate it. And also it was a source of anti-Russian sentiment. And that's another thing that he wants to eliminate. The challenge here, though, is, and this is what everyone is concerned about, even if, like, some of the what Putin wants, and it's very clear Trump is trying to deliver that from, is even if they give up the eastern part of Ukraine, and there's real moral issues about that for the people that live in the eastern side that don't want to be part of a Russian Federation. I mean, the people in Eastern Europe, the reason why the Ukrainians are fighting for their survival is they don't want to be part of this global oligarchy, with a dictator in operation. They've had a taste of democracy and they want to keep going on that. But I think the bigger problem here is what he wants is peace. He wants to end the conflict. It's only a temporary measure. And effectively what he wants is the demilitarization of Ukraine, which is really questionable. Because if that happens, essentially what's going to happen is down the road, Putin has this option to roll in there. And what all the other countries are concerned about is, and this is what his original plan was, he was going to roll into Ukraine, take that Ukrainian army and use that to go into other European countries. But the big seismic change that has happened this week, and it was always on the horizon and glaringly obvious, to be honest, is the US will not intervene if he goes after any of the smaller countries in Eastern Europe. They won't, NATO won't be, and we've pushed us towards this European militarisation. Now, what I care from as a children's rights campaigner is I know what that means. It means that governments investing huge amounts of money in defence, rising taxes and then actually cutting public services. So
more
ordinary
guns,
people
less border. Okay.
Actually pay the price.
Okay. Just before I come to you, Harry, so after all that, Bridget, can I ask you, can this war be won on terms favourable to the Ukrainians? And if so, what does that look like?
No. Is the answer, but I think there's...
So cut and run now?
No, there's a big difference between what I would call a dictated peace and a negotiated peace, because you cannot ask Ukraine to stop with no security guarantees, because the Russians would use the time to beef up the army again and roll again. And so, but remember, there's also there's a deep European interest in this, because Moscow has been supporting the radical right through the continent. So this really is a battle at its highest level between the maintenance of European democracies that are already internally challenged, countries like like Hungary is not a democracy in my view, and so it's security, and it's about security, it's about democracy, and it's about the entitlement of those people to choose the kind of world they want to be part of.
Okay. Harry, you picked a piece from the Sunday Independent. Trump's rant has brought prospects of an EU army one step closer.
Yeah, I mean, the debate over neutrality and over in Ireland and over the prospect of an EU army has really come to the fore. I think it's reflected somewhat in the Sunday Independent poll, which we'll come
to.
We'll
come to
presently. But the difficulty is that defence spending. Pete Hegseth, the US Defence Secretary, said that the US interests lie elsewhere now. So the whole architecture of NATO and the whole rationale that the...
By the way, I'll just give you on a point of information on that, Harry, and you can continue then. So overnight, David J. Freeman, who's a political commentator, a MAGA political commentator, tweeted, "It's time to leave NATO and the UN." Elon Musk tweeted, "I agree." And back to what we were talking about with Mark Little yesterday, I think a lot of people starting to think that J.D. Vance and also Elon Musk are the kind of ideological, intellectual wing that is driving the Trump. But go on anyway.
Yeah, and I'd agree 100%. So if those eventualities do happen, I mean, the question then is how is Europe going to respond to that? And what can Europe do? The America has effectively provided a backstop against Russian aggression during the Cold War and in the period afterwards. And if America withdraws that backstop, what can Europe do in those circumstances? And what is the shape of that backstop? One of the questions that was asked about the Ukrainian request for a backstop from the US is, what does it look like? Is it strategic military intelligence? Is it hardware? Is it the nuclear option, the nuclear option in case of unfettered nuclear aggression? And the same applies to NATO. And the thing about Russia is that Russia doesn't play by the rules that we play by. It doesn't play by any rules. And it seems that Donald Trump isn't playing by any rules at present either. So we're looking at a world, at a global political context that seems to be deeply dysfunctional at the moment.
Okay.
I think there is an onus on Europe in those circumstances to look very closely at its own defence capabilities. I think 1.8% of GDP is the spending across the EU's 27 on average at the moment. It's way lower here in Ireland.
Okay.
It's only a fraction of 1%. And there is a need for that to be bolstered. They're talking about €300 billion in the short term, but you're talking about billions, hundreds of billions of euro in the long term. But it's something that might need to be done.
And look, that very conversation happening today in Downing Street, where Prime Minister Keir Starmer will host a summit of international leaders about Ukraine this afternoon. Ahead of that, right now, interestingly, he's meeting Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, I think, a one-on-one. Lucy Fisher is Whitehall editor at the Financial Times. Good morning, Lucy.
Good morning.
Lucy, what's happening today?
Well, as you say, Starmer is meeting Meloni right now for bilaterals. She's obviously a key cog in this wider machine of what happens next, given her very close relations with Donald Trump. And of course, indeed, considering that Italy spends only around 1.5% of GDP on defence, it's one of the real laggards among the bigger economies in Europe on defence expenditure. And then, of course, the big action this afternoon is the summit in Lancaster House, a grand mansion near Buckingham Palace in London, where Starmer will be welcoming 16 other leaders alongside Meloni. We know that President Zelensky will be there, Macron, Olaf Scholz from Germany, Donald Tusk from Poland, and Ursula von der Leyen from the EU. And the real push today is to try and outline some kind of peace deal that Ukraine could sign up to, that then the UK and France will present to President Trump in order to try and move forward with the sort of peace deal and ceasefire that
the tactic that we've seen people talk about in the Middle East, that Trump comes up with some kind of unworkable idea, but then the ball's in other people's court to come up with something more reasonable and acceptable. And the hope would be they come back to Trump with that. Yes.
Well, that's right. But I think that the sticking point here is that the UK and France are going to make clear that they would be willing to put boots on the ground in Ukraine following any ceasefire as part of a reassurance force that would protect nuclear sites, ports, infrastructure, larger cities. Not necessarily many other European capitals coming forward with that offer so far. Poland, okay, very reticent, others reticent. But the key thing is that the London and Paris offer to do so is absolutely predicated on the US offering a security backstop, perhaps air cover, perhaps satellite access and so forth. And Trump has made clear he does not want to give necessarily any military support inside Ukraine.
So do you have any sense, Lucy, is what the mood is like around this? Like, is it fairly downbeat, or are people hopeful they could come up with something useful?
I think there is a huge degree of nervousness. You know, officials across Europe are bracing. You know, the enormity of this moment cannot be overstated. We've seen sort of former NATO commander, Admiral James Stradivarius, been, you know, telling CNN in the past sort of 12 hours that he thinks this is the beginning of the end of NATO. You know, is this going to be, you know, the US sort of pulling out for all intents and purposes? Even if it not formally, you know, if it can't be relied on to sort of support Article 5, that an attack on one is an attack on all, then, you know, we are entering a new epoch potentially. So I think, you know, Keir Starmer has been out this morning to say that it's a turning point in the Ukraine war, but it is a turning point in a grand strategic context for the entire European continent.
And just before you go, Lucy, you alluded there to the Giorgia Meloni meeting that Starmer is having right now. And she's an interesting person because it has been noted that she has kept very silent at the moment. She's been very loyal to Ukraine. I think it was not entirely expected she would be when she before she was elected, but she has, unlike some of the far right, stayed very loyal to Ukraine, but at the same time has that relationship with Trump and with Elon Musk. So do you think there is there a view that she could be some kind of an important interlocutor here?
I think that's absolutely right. You know, and as you say, you know, there was a concern before, you know, when she was won the election, but before she'd sort of taken control in Italy, that she, you know, could end up, you know, strengthening Italy's traditional relations with Russia. And that also hasn't sort of come about in the way that her critics feared. But yes, you know, she's got this warm rapport with Trump. She's much more of a worldview with him. You know, Trump and Starmer, we saw, got along great in the Oval Office last week. You know, there was a lot of bonhomie between him and Macron too. But, you know, they all parties would admit they, you know, they have a different worldview. Trump is much more perhaps imperialist in outlook, whereas, you know, the UK and France are liberal social, you know, democracies, whereas Meloni has a much more similar worldview, perhaps, to Donald Trump, and that might prove useful.
OK, Lucy Fisher, Whitehall editor at the Financial Times, thank you very much for that catch up. If we go back a million years ago now, Bridget, to what started this current kind of movement of events, the White House on Friday, yeah, unbelievably, Friday. I think you were looking at that Louise Callanan piece in the Sunday Times, and she does kind of gently note in it that some of Zelensky's Ukrainian allies are gently saying, and I saw some of them out over the last few days, reluctantly, his former finance minister kind of reluctantly saying it, a former advisor of his who's now an academic in the UK, saying, look, I don't really want to talk about this, but did Zelensky screw up? And do a lot of Ukrainians think he did screw up?
So it's very difficult to know because on the one hand, he was called a dictator by said President Trump in the recent past.
But there had been a winding back,
and there had been a winding back
as the week went on.
But also, so I think he was very unwise publicly, because whatever messages he needed to give to Trump and Vance should have been done privately, because we know that they run foreign policy now on television and they don't like being taken on. But I also am convinced that they knew what they were doing, that they went into that meeting.
But it was an ambush.
For them, for the Trump administration, they see Zelensky as a barrier to the quick deal. And if you think about it, the first US demand was basically a grab on their mineral rights. So, and also a lot of disinformation on what the US had given. So Zelensky finds himself, I think Zelensky would resign as president of Ukraine, provided there were guarantees to the future security of his country. I think
Do you think that's the space we're in now?
that's the space. I think certainly the Americans, or at least the American administration, wants Zelensky out.
Do you think the rest of us coming around?
No, it would be very bad for really bad for Ukraine to lose.
And Ukrainians Zelensky. have seemed to be rowing in behind him a lot as well, but maybe more in sorrow than in anger. On the figures that Trump is putting out, I don't think we hear this enough. So I'm just going to, I was checking figures there. According to the Kiel Institute for the World Economy, which is apparently a very reputable source, in terms of contributions made to aid to Ukraine during this war, the USA has contributed $119 billion. Europe has contributed $138. And we don't hear that figure because we hear Trump's figure all the time.
And everything's
half a billion with Trump. Yeah. Peter Brown, just before we leave that, as a person who is no stranger to doing a deal or whatever, what was your view on how the White House played out on Friday?
Well, I absolutely think that the journalist who asked the question about why he wasn't wearing a suit didn't do that off his own bat. You would not insult the President of the United States of America's guest by asking him a question like that. That was set up.
He's called Brian Glenn, and he's the boyfriend of Marjorie Taylor.
So that was an absolute setup. And J.D. Vance's attack.
And Trump had already said the first thing he said to Zelensky was, "Oh, you're all dressed up," and then shouted over to the press corps, "He's got all dressed up today, you know."
Yeah. Well, of course, we've got that picture.
Why doesn't he ask the same question of Elon Musk?
We have that
going
picture
into the cabinet meeting wearing a baseball hat.
Absolutely.
And jeans.
And we have that picture in the paper today of Winston Churchill in his fatigues.
In
the White House.
Fatigues.
In his war fatigues.
So you think whole thing set up.
Whole thing set up.
And did Zelensky rose to the bait then, did he? Like,
well, I think he rose to the bait because he was goaded so badly. And he rose to the bait. But Zelensky now...
And he's been 3 years at war and et cetera.
Yeah. But the interesting thing is Zelensky's now gone from a meeting with Trump, pressurised to concede, to get a deal with Russia, till now he's sitting in a meeting with his European allies, right? And I'm sure that meeting is, look, we can't finance this forever. You're going to have to come to a compromise. He's in the exact same position, no matter where he goes, Ukraine is in a compromise.
The head of NATO, Mark Rutte, has now twice apparently said to Zelensky since Friday, you need to go back and fix your relationship with America.
It looked like a scene out of The Godfather, like a mafia shakedown. Yeah. The supplicant arrives into the restaurant and Vito Corleone, Leone, and his right-hand thug is there to give him a dressing down. And the overriding message was, might is right. But I listened back to the whole transcript, Brendan, over the course of the weekend. Or I listened back to the whole thing. And I think Zelensky spent too long with his preliminary remarks. Yeah. He went into too much detail and he made too much demands publicly. And then he started showing photographs of what had happened. And you could see that Donald Trump was getting completely irritated. There's history between himself and Zelensky. He has a personal animus towards him. He believes that when they looked for dirt on Hunter Biden in 2016, that Zelensky and the Ukrainians didn't give them support. He referred to that during the course of the thing.
And Trump was impeached over that issue, wasn't it? The first impeachment of Trump.
Absolutely.
Was over that. Yeah.
So, and with Trump, as everybody knows by now, the personal is sometimes more important than the global. And then you had J.D. Vance jumping in. I have no doubt that this was a pre-contrived ambush.
Okay. We'll take a break. Peter Brown, Harry McGee, Tanya Ward, and Professor Bridget Laffin staying with us. Welcome back, Peter Brown, Harry McGee, Tanya Ward, Professor Bridget Laffin still with us. And look, all politics is local, of course. So everything we were talking about for the first while there comes down to it. It all impacts now on Micheál Martin will go and have his audience with Donald Trump on March 12th. So, Harry, tell us about what the poll in the Sunday Independent suggests about how people feel Micheál Martin should approach this.
Yes, Brendan. It's a poll that was conducted by Ireland Thinks on behalf of the Sunday Independent. I think the poll, the overall number of people polled was 1,373. It was sampled over Friday and Saturday, which means it captures some of the events that took place in the White House
And margin of 2.7%. 2.7%. Plus or minus,
But it does show the public in surprisingly pragmatic vein in terms of how Micheál Martin should approach his meeting with Trump. And I think some of that was tempered by the way in which Emmanuel Macron and Keir Starmer approached their White House visits during the week, using the Flurry Knox School of Diplomacy with Trump while trying to get their points across at the same time.
So the figures on it are that
43% agree that there should be direct criticism of the president's policies, mainly on Gaza and Ukraine. But then 50% are of the opinion that there should be no lecture. So more people think that the Taoiseach should not lecture President Trump than those who do.
OK, it's more, a smallish majority suggested in this
but
poll.
But it's telling,
anyway.
Nonetheless. The Sinn Féin boycott, for example, which has been supported by some other parties, 38% agree, 48% disagree. A lot of these kind of divide along party lines, so you see more support for all of these things among Sinn Féin supporters than others. And then the topics, 51% think the topic should be tariffs. Only 18% think it should be Gaza, which has been a huge issue in Ireland.
Yeah.
16% Ukraine. And then 12% think that the main focus should be in relation to the undocumented Irish. Some interesting figures on neutrality and a European army, which shows we're still agin, but the figures are changing. You can see a kind of a gradual change of public sentiment towards sacred cows, essentially, like neutrality and NATO and a European army. And I thought those findings were also very interesting.
Yeah, there is actually an interesting statistic in it there that more people think we should join NATO, according to this poll, than actually think we should compromise on our neutrality. So we're hard to get your head around that one. So staying with the Taoiseach going to Washington then. Tanya, you picked a piece in the Sunday Independent also, Gabby Agathovets-Keita writing, Taoiseach due to be briefed within an inch of his life before a trip.
That's right. And I mean, she starts the article by pointing out, and this is a really interesting point that many of us might neglected to notice, is that when the invite went out for Keir Starmer coming to the White House, they said the Prime Minister and Donald Trump welcomed the United Kingdom, Great Britain and Ireland, right?
And he did. Trump referred with Keir Starmer to the fact that he owned a golf course in the UK and Ireland.
Right. Yeah,
in Scotland.
Now they don't think that he thinks that Ireland is part of the United Kingdom. They think he's well aware of that. So they're wondering what the point is behind that. And I suppose, as you can imagine, the officials are working hard. They're working hard connecting with delegations in the US, and they are wargaming with Micheál Martin about how to respond to the different issues.
Do you think the suggestion in that poll is right, that he should not go over there and get into Gaza and Ukraine and should just focus on jobs for Ireland?
No, I think he has to go over and start with tariffs, right? Because that's one of the things that's going to impact ordinary people at home. He has to have that discussion. It's going to be part of what the EU wants as well. It's not going to have any effect whatsoever on what Trump does, because even, you know, the experts in the US have explained to him that this is going to result in a Great Depression in our economy. It hasn't worked. I mean, it's really down to the US media to explain to their own public about the impact of what that's going to do. And that does impact how Trump behaves. But I do think he should, and in closed doors, not in public, because we need to learn from what happened on Friday. Trump is a reality TV star. He is, and they are worried.
Don't fact check him live on TV then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's the issue with Trump is, and you can see this with the Irish public, that's why they're so pragmatic. He's an image-led leader. So if you attack him in public, he'll have a personal grudge and he'll come down on you. So tactically, it's never worth, you have to, and I suppose the article is saying that, you know, he's been schooled on how to correct tactically, but in truth, what they should do is try and avoid something public, because there is a risk here. He's going to dress him down, Micheál Martin, in public, potentially in relation to our support for Gaza and Palestine.
That Trump might dress him down.
No, Trump might dress Micheál Martin down, and also maybe in relation to Ukraine as well. So this is very challenging territory. But look, Micheál Martin is a very experienced politician, and it's something that he has to think about. And the other thing I think he needs to do as well when he goes over there, he needs to run deep and reach out to the wider Republican Party and maintain those links, because into the future it may happen. You know, it's sometime after the election, they might actually get a bit of a spine and do something.
Yeah, OK. Bridget, you were shaking your head there.
I would expect Micheál Martin to handle the meetings well, and I would expect him to, any messages he wants to send on issues that would be controversial, he should do so in private, if in one-to-one, and not in public. But I think from
This speaking as a Cork person myself, we are all Irish people are masters of passive aggression, but Cork people are really world champions so at this passive aggressive.
He needs to call on all of his son's football house. But much more importantly than the visit is the challenge to Ireland from the Trump administration in terms of tariffs and FDI. And there's firstly on the tariffs, they're using tariffs as a threat, as a negotiating and bargaining ploy, but also as hardcore protectionism. So they avoided the tariffs on Canada and Mexico for a month, but they're going ahead.
They're happening next week,
and
apparently.
10% plus on China. So the idea that Europe is going to get away with no tariffs, I find highly unlikely and impossible.
So this view that you could con Trump with, like, giving him some kind of an old a half-cocked deal that he could go home and sell as a win at home, maybe that's changing, is it?
I think it probably is, but you have to try. From an Irish perspective, the big threat at the moment would be pharma. And then after that, he's also talking about the OECD tax deal. Again, that can hit us. So I would say that we need to get very smart on right across the range, whole of government. This is Brexit on steroids.
Yeah. Okay, and I think we are convening all kinds of committees.
The
and
one thing Peter we have going for us, though, right on we are the sixth biggest investor into the US, and particular companies, investors like Ryanair, keeping Boeing alive in Seattle. So
yeah, but it's 36 billion over 10 years on planes. It's 130,000 jobs. Peter, two questions for you, right? Yeah. A, do we have any kind of a scale to tell when we get over there that is going to be have any impact on Trump's thinking? And second, just give me in bald terms what effect tariffs would have on us.
Okay, just Lady first Bird. In terms, when you talk about investment, we're the biggest investor. That's mainly American multinational money here that's investing in US bonds. That's what it is. That's mainly big. That's why we're so big. But anyhow, so do we have any negotiating position? Yeah, we do. We've got a very deep, I think, you know, what Bridget says here about the way Micheál Martin has to play this. Absolutely. Do not attack him in public. Right. If you want to raise Gaza and things like that, you've got to do that in private. Do not attack him in public. Right. He is going to home in on the fact that Ireland is making billions upon billions upon billions of tax revenues exporting stuff to the United States of America. And as you rightly say, 50% of that's pharma. Right. That's very exposed. OK, so he has to kind of turn around and say, look, you know, that Ryanair thing about we buy all your Boeing jets and things like that, that's positive. So he needs to try and balance that argument as best he can. OK, the risk to Ireland on the tariffs. So what tariffs are is a way of penalising people who import, who export goods to you, make them very expensive so that people buy domestic. Right. Now, the argument is, are they producing the pharmaceutical goods that we're exporting to them? They're probably not. Right. So who's going to wear the 25%? And when we talk about negotiating tariffs, it's the EU that negotiate tariffs, not Ireland. We don't negotiate tariffs with America. The EU negotiate tariffs. If he does 25% on the EU, we're going to get 25% on what we export to the United States. The question then to the pharmaceutical companies and the tech companies is, can we up the prices 25%? Will the US consumer absorb that? Or do we need to start absorbing it? And if we do, that's going to have a massive impact.
Okay.
On Irish
a lot of the pharma we're exporting there, if I'm not wrong, is half-finished stuff from American pharma companies here, isn't it? Does that help the matter in any way? Then I remember the first morning when the tariffs in Mexico and Canada were announced. The bank holiday Monday, I was walking around and I met Colin McCarthy. And I said, geez, this is starting to look scary. Like, and do you think our farmer's going to be in trouble? And he said, it's very hard to fold up a factory and put it into your pocket and head off.
No, and absolutely. No. So the risk is not
to the existing
leaving. The risk is when we sell it, do we have to collapse our price by 20% to offset the tariffs, which means less profits, less tax revenue for the Irish government? It's not a risk of these companies going to move, right? Things now. The Trump tariff policy, just to say, is a bullying tactic. That's what it is. It's a negotiating tactic to bring people to the table. You saw after the meeting with Keir Starmer, we can do a trade deal with you. We don't need tariffs, right? You know, so tariffs are off the table, right? So really what the Americans want is they want a level playing field. Like, so we tax American imports, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, we're putting tax on them, things like that. So there's a deal to be done on tariffs. And it's a question of what does he want? The real risk, I think, here is the way that we book our profits and the amount of profits that they are off American multinationals. That's something that okay. I have no question they're going to hold.
So our whole tax game,
that's,
like, is...
That's the danger.
Okay. Harry, what's the sense you're getting in the world of Leinster House about the concerns around all this?
Well, obviously, there are big concerns about it. Senator Maloney in the Sunday Independent this morning, a great colleague, but stated the very obvious when he said that Micheál Martin will not want to repeat the performance of Volodymyr Zelensky when he visits them in the White House on the 12th of March.
We will have to
be extraordinarily careful. Micheál Martin will have to be extraordinarily careful in the way that he approaches it. And he is experienced, and he is now, and he's a political pragmatist. But at the same time, there are always dangers involved in that. The one saving grace is that what we saw, the outburst that we saw from Trump with Zelensky was an outlier. He's usually very personally charming to those who come. And then he reserves his criticism for the tweets that come maybe 24 hours afterwards, or the X posts that come 24, or Truth Social posts that come 24 hours afterwards. But again, I mean, I think that Micheál Martin will have an obligation to the Irish public as well. And I think that he will have to mention Gaza. I think he will have to mention Ukraine in public. In a sort of voce way.
Does everyone agree with that?
No, I don't think he does in public, I think.
Tanya?
I think there's an expectation he'll do it, but he doesn't need to do it alongside Trump. And he can do it in an artful way, highlighting the role of the US in securing peace and what that might look like.
So we're all agreed it would be kamikaze
It will be done in public at some stage. It mightn't be done in the Oval Office during that thing, but it will certainly be done in public, and will have to be.
Avoid doing it in the Oval Office, I think, is the trick.
Yeah. Okay. Listen... Let's move on, right? Because the big issue for people, really, and again, look, you can see it in that poll, but it's in all the polls, right? The big issue for people, all that notwithstanding, is housing. And there's interesting in that poll to see the very high support there is for the so-called log cabins in the back garden, suggested in that poll anyway. There's a vast majority in favour of them, and a vast majority think either they or one of their relatives would live in a log cabin. So, Peter, on that, people do seem to be now ready for a bit more out of the box and whatever will work and stuff like that. So you picked a few pieces on housing. But I think you have your own kind of big idea on this, don't you?
I do, yeah.
Yeah,
I do.
Go on, throw this out there now and see how the others enjoy this.
The first thing I want to say is I'm not in the building business, and I don't own land, and I'm not a property developer or anything like that. So we built 85 to 100,000 houses a year back in the noughties, for the wrong reason. We built very poor quality ones because they weren't controlled, and we built them for the wrong reasons because we were going to make a lot of money on them, but there was actually nobody to want them, right? Now, we have, but we managed to do that. We attracted massive amount of foreign labour, Romanian, Polish, Latvian, Lithuanian, builders all across the board, right, who were thinking they're going to make a fortune because we'd sell these houses, and the thing collapsed, right? Now we do have the demand for these houses. We've got the demand for way more than 30, 40,000 houses a year. We've got the demand here for 100,000 houses a year for 5 years, 500,000 houses, retail units, and maybe 700,000. We've got that demand, massive demand. So what we have to create here, there's two sides to this, right? One is the government's responsibility, and the second is we've got to create an environment where developers and builders make a lot of money out of building these houses, which doesn't exist at the moment, right? It doesn't. Now, I know
the big building companies, I think, is it Cairn Homes or the other one? Sure, their profits are up again this year. They're earning profits at 15, 16, 17, 18%.
There's an article here that 69,000 houses started in 2024, and they reckon only 50% will be built because they're not sure they can make money out of it.
Okay, right? So go on.
So we need to create a situation where it's massively profitable for developers and builders and landowners to build residential units. And that has to be a reduction in tax. There has to be a reduction in tax. Make it really, really efficient to make profit. That means the banks will finance it because they're confident that the builders will
make money. How much taxes should these private builders and investors be paying?
I'm not the tax expert, but I'm going to a level where it's just a no-brainer that we actually kind of will see foreign building companies bringing their labour in here to build out these units over a 5-year period. Now,
and they pay how much tax here? None.
I'm saying that we're not getting the tax on them anyhow. Right? I want a COVID response that is astonishing. Now, people are going to turn around and say, well, that's just disgraceful.
But they pay no tax.
They can pay small amount of tax or whatever, but I want them to make a large profit. I want it to be an event for 5 years that building house, residential houses, according to the Trex planning law, and to standard, that it is a place to go. Ireland is a place to go and there's a place to do it.
Will they be affordable?
That brings the price down.
But does it though?
Yes, it does, because it brings the supply, right?
That has been one of the issues with relying on private investment, because I agree with you, right? This is going to be solved by private investment, private builders working alongside a public investment programme. It's actually what I do think. But if you look at what's happened with some of the big building programs that have happened, it's the cost of the apartments to rent has been through the roof. My own sister, there was an apartment block built not too far from our family home. She was like, this is great. Went down to have a look at the price, $2,800 for a two-bedroom apartment to rent. I mean, it's just not feasible. But the other side of it is, and then to actually buy. So most people on lower incomes won't be able. I mean, there's a reason why.
But people on an average income
That's 70% of people supporting the granny flat. That's desperation. Yeah,
the reason that prices, rents are high and house prices are selling at 10-20% over asking is there's not enough of them.
But they, and those bigger
the government's
companies,
present policy of 40,000 a year, that's going to be 50,000 a year behind. But aren't there hundreds of thousands as well?
I mean, construction inflation has been really high.
Yes.
For materials.
Yes.
And also labour has been a problem as well.
Yes.
That despite the best intentions, developers have had difficulty in accessing adequate labour. And then when you need to get more labour, you create an additional layer of difficulties in that they have to be accommodated too.
Can I just respond? Yeah.
Right? If you create a situation where it is really profitable to build houses, you get competitive building, you bring in labour from abroad, you swamp the system with people building units, that satisfies the demand, it brings the house prices down. It takes out the people who are going to buy them as investments, because they think, oh, on a second, these prices are coming down, so I'm not going to bother. So that takes a whole sector out of the market that's trying to buy houses to invest. And you create that situation. Government then has to step in and provide this block.
Can I just say, the
other model is a public building model, a bit like Vienna, where the government comes in and commissions the building. They have a better handle at keeping prices down and maintaining quality.
So the government as coordinator, Dublin Docklands style thing. Before we go to a break, Harry, there are a number of pieces across the papers today about Dáil speaking rights. I think this is worth 1 minute, so go on.
Okay. Each of them are saying it's a waste of time, but it's not. It's not a waste of print, obviously, because we're still talking about it. So it's definitely an inside baseball type argument. There's an important principle. One of the effects of it has been is that it has consolidated the opposition for the opposition.
You were writing about it yesterday about a change in tone in this Dáil, that it's gotten a bit nastier.
It has. It's far more confrontational. I think Shane Coleman in the Sunday Business Post was saying that Sinn Féin have gone back to a more confrontational style of opposition. They're more kind of government style in the 33rd Dáil. But one of the effects of it has been that Labour, the Soc Dems, the smaller opposition parties and Sinn Féin have come together on this issue. And as Padraig McLaughlin, the chief whip of Sinn Féin, was telling me, he said, you know, for the first time, the public are beginning to see the shape of what might be an alternative government. So even though the government has had a victory on this, it could be a Pyrrhic victory in his estimation.
OK, we'll take a break. Peter Brown, Harry McGee, Tanya Ward and Professor Bridget Laffin staying with us. Panel are still here. Peter Brown, Harry McGee, Tanya Ward and Professor Bridget Laffin. And can I say, it's a testament to you. I could go on with you all day and there's so much we didn't get to, but we are nearly at the end of our time. Harry McGee, sad news yesterday at the death of the people's poet, Pat Inglesby.
Yeah, he was a remarkable man who had overcome mental illness in the 1960s as a young man. and become a public poet, essentially. He always reminded me of the 17th century, 16th century, 17th century Irish poets, the poets of the dispossessed who had once been courtly poets but had lost their station when all of that system had fallen apart. Seachtain Caoimhín, Dathaoibh Obrúder. I remember him on telly when I was a kid. He'd be on a lot of the youth programmes. And it sounded on the face of it like doggerel, but I mean, it was humorous and upbeat poem. But there was always a great kind of human quality to it, a bathos to it, always.
And then, even when he did become kind of dispossessed from the court, I think a lot of people knew him from the streets where he hung out selling his books. A lot of people would stop for a chat with him, and Pat often brightened up everyone's day.
On Grafton Street, often. And actually, he said that he would like his death plaque to read, in solidarity with the women with the prams who went on Moore Street, he said, Pat Inglesby was moved from here. which I thought was a great line from him.
Yeah, and as you say, he was very determined to help others. He spoke openly about his own mental health challenges, and he had a great hope that people would find solace in his work when they needed it in their lives. So actually, you don't remember a lot of the stuff you do here because, like, it's a waterfall, like, and you move on. But one of the things that I do remember as one of the lovely things about this job is I got to talk to Pat Inglesby in 2022. He hadn't really done an interview in years. He was a bit suspicious and everything, but they were releasing a documentary, a beautiful documentary that people should go and seek out, that I presume will be shown on RTÉ again in the coming days, The Peculiar Sensation of Being Pat Inglesby. But it was a wonderful conversation, and we'll finish on a clip from it. Here he is talking about being inspired by Johnny Cash and meeting the man himself. So thank you very much to my panel this morning.
Johnny Cash, I read a lot about him. I read a book called Winners Got Scars 2, and all during my psychiatric nightmarish periods, his inspiration made a big difference to me. So when he was appearing in the Olympia Theatre, I decided to go and tell him that. I hadn't got a ticket, but because I was well known, I knew what to do. I just knocked on the side stage door, and of course the hatch came back. All right, Pat, you coming in? So in I went. And I did an unforgivable thing. I waited at the bottom of the stairs from the dressing rooms, because I knew that's the way he'd be coming, and he was almost on the stage at that point. And I stepped out in front of him. There were two miners with him. He looked like Mount Rushmore on legs. And I expected to be thrown out, because if I was coming down from the dressing room anywhere to go on stage and somebody stepped in front of me, I'd be furious. He opened his shoulders. He was warm. I thanked him for the difference he helped me in my life. And then he said to me, "Are you coming to the show?" And I said, "Well, to be honest with you, I came in through the side door." So he said to one of his minders, "Get Pat a chair and put him in the wings." And then before he went out on stage, he signed my autograph book with a lovely, big, round, flowing hand. "God bless you, Pat. Johnny Cash." And I've written a poem since, and it simply says, "If dying was good enough for Johnny Cash, it would do me, you know." I mean, he was so beautifully human.
To me,
that's a star.
And that's the late, great Pat Inglesby, who was beautifully human himself and an absolute star. So it's just after 12 noon, and we'll go to the newsroom now and Karen Creed.